Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries around the world on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on modern money mechanics. Harry Figge Jr. He operates a company called Figge International, located in Willoughby, Ohio. In 1988, he made a series of speeches, in which one of them is recorded, and it's contained in a little booklet. Now, last time we were talking about Ron Paul, the only advocate that I know of in Congress advocating sound money. He's decidedly in the minority, and the majority of Americans, 290 million of us strong, are in favor of paper money, income tax, stocks and bonds, negotiable instruments, usury and interest. We believe in our economy. Harry Figge believes in that same economy, believes in that same paper money, believes in that same system. The banking system that we all look to today as being the norm. It's normal. But Figge, in his speeches, expressed concern about the national debt and the budget deficits during the Reagan and the Bush years, $250 billion a year. And he went around and he expressed his opinion based upon the Grace Commission report. So I'm going to interject the Figge report right here in the second program of our analysis on the subject of modern money mechanics. Then we'll come back to Ron Paul. Here's what Figge had to say concerning our budget deficits. He said, "I want to thank you for the opportunity to address you today on the subject of the national debt. And I want to stress first and foremost that I'm a businessman, and I have never been and never intend to be involved in politics. However, if you wonder why I'm up here, I really love my country. And because, as I tell people, where else but in the United States could a person from very humble means, whose father died when he was 16, follow his life plan and build two companies? And I'm here today because I fully believe that this great country of ours is heading into serious trouble because of the government's dangerous inability to reduce its debt or to control the ongoing budget deficits." He said, "I became involved in this issue quite by accident in 1982 when Peter Grace made me co-chairman of the President's Private Sector Survey on Cost Control. It was called the Grace Commission. And as a result of that, I became privy to some information that I wish I'd never heard about. Information that showed me how threatening our government spending policies really are. This past Tuesday, I met with several congressmen on the subject, including Congressman Dennis Eckert from Cleveland and Congressman Dick Armey from Texas, and I showed six different congressmen the debt and the deficit projections for the next few years, and every one of them said, 'Gee, I didn't know it was that bad,' or 'I didn't realize where we were headed.' They had no idea that the ball game's going to be over in 1995. Dick was an economics professor and is probably the most knowledgeable man in Congress on economics. After I showed him the projections, Dick Armey said, 'Harry, you just ruined my day.' And I said, 'Well, it's about time. Peter ruined mine in 1982, and I haven't had a good one since. Now, surveys show how that the national debt and the deficit are uppermost in the minds of the American people. Congress recognizes this, and they say that it was the savings and loan crisis that finally brought it home to the American people. But I say it was perfectly understandable all along, because the Americans have been struggling personally with debts and deficits and budgets all of their lives, and they know what happens to them if they don't live within their personal income. So naturally, they begin to worry when they see a profitable country that is not living within its income and hasn't lived within its income since 1952. Now, I want to put this massive problem into the context of the person in the street and show you why the government is headed into real trouble. Let's say that you have a net take-home pay of $1,000, and you take $100 of that $1,000 and put it into some kind of a pension plan, you know, like a Kroger or an IRA or a 401k, and the other $900 just makes ends meet. Now, let's suppose somebody gives you some free credit cards, and they give you American Express, Visa, MasterCard, Discover, whatever you want, but you realize that you cannot use these credit cards. You can't use them because you're just barely able to pay your expenses out of the $900 that you take home every month. Well, then all of a sudden, you meet a very tall man with a long white beard, a big stovepipe hat, red and white striped pants, and a blue coat and stars all over it, and he says, "My name is Sam. I am Uncle Sam. I'm a financial advisor, and I want you to follow my advice. I want you to use those credit cards. And when they bill you, just send them a 30-year IOU at 8% interest." And you say, "Yeah, but I have to pay the interest even if they accept the IOUs." Sam says, "Well, do you remember that $100 that you were putting in a pension? Well, you take that $100 and you use that to pay the interest, and you put an IOU in your pension plan. And then 20 years from now, you'll have 20 years of IOUs. But what do you care?" And you remind him, "Uncle Sam, there's a difference between you and me. You see, you've got a printing press in your basement, which gives you unlimited credit. But if I do that, I'll go to jail." And that's why Americans are concerned, because they know that we can't keep going on like this. Before I go any further, let me explain the difference between deficit and debt, for those of you that might not be familiar with the terms. The deficit is the shortfall that we have in any one year. So if you take $100 billion in, and then you spend $110 billion, you get a deficit of $10 billion. Now, at the end of the year, you've got to do something with that $10 billion you owe, so you move it over into your long-term shortfall, and that becomes your debt. In 1982, the annual deficit was $128 billion. That was up from $4 billion in 1974. Now, the debt in 1982 was at $1 trillion. That was up from $484 billion in 1974. Now, it had taken us 200 years from the start of our republic in 1787 until 1974 to create that debt of $484 billion. We had gone through World War I, World War II, the Korean War, Vietnam, and we still had a very manageable situation. But since 1982, when the debt first hit $1 trillion, our debt has now tripled. It is now $3 trillion in 1988. Now, when Peter Grace called me and a number of others down to Washington in 1982, we were commissioned by President Reagan to find some savings in government. And I can tell you, it was like shooting fish in a rain barrel. We contributed $77 million of corporate money and about 500 employees, and we found more than $424 billion in savings in about 9 months. And we could easily have identified over $1 trillion in savings that our national government could take advantage of. But President Reagan was not interested in going any further. Now, of the $424 billion that we identified, Congress instituted $152 billion in savings by 1986. Now, spread out annually, that averages $38 billion in savings a year. And at that same time, President Reagan pushed through a $50 billion tax increase. Now, if you take that $50 billion of new revenue and the $38 billion that we saved, that's $88 billion a year. That should have gone to reduce the deficit, which at that time was $128 billion. So we should have dropped the annual deficit from $128 billion down to $40 billion. But instead of that, the government says we ran a $152 billion deficit that year. Now, the problem is, over the past 10 years, government revenue has risen at 8% a year, compounded. But our expenditures have gone up 11% per year, compounded. That doesn't sound like very much, but let me put it in perspective for you. Right now, Congress has 116% more money to spend than they had 10 years ago, but they have spent 186% more than they spent 10 years ago. You see, every time that you give Congress $1, they're spending between $1.58 and $1.68. And I'll tell you what I learned in Washington. They not only don't understand this problem, they don't even care about it. They don't want to know about it. Now, the thing that finally brought me up short and has ruined my last 8 years were the projections. You see, Peter Grace and the Grace Commission got from this economist. And these numbers that I'm going to give you, I've had verified in the last 6 months by the Citizens Against Government Waste. So they are very current. Now, here in America, we're at $1 trillion in debt in 1982. That debt is going to go to $13 trillion in the year 2000. And we were at an annual deficit of $128 billion, and the deficit is going to go to $2 trillion. Now, let me graph the debt on my thumb and forefinger. Now, I've got my thumb horizontal and my finger is vertical. Now, you've got 1776 way out here at the tip of my thumb. The debt line runs along my thumb, absolutely flat until 1976. Then, the line gets up into the web of my thumb in about 1980 and starts to come up. And by 1995, we're at the first knuckle of my finger. Now, you turn asymptomatic. You start going straight up, and by the year 2000, we're straight up at the top. Now you can see what our problem is here. It's excessive spending. It isn't that Congress doesn't have enough money, or didn't have enough money back in the 1980s. But what they did was every time they got in a dollar, they went ahead and spent $1.18 or $1.50. In other words, they just kept running up the budget deficits and running up the national debt. And the people of America didn't really care too much about it. You didn't see them voting Ted Kennedy out now, did you? You didn't see anybody voting out Dole or Arlen Specter or any of those guys? No. And that's because the average guy on the street can't grasp modern money mechanics. Now, my old Uncle Lyle explained to me back in, well, I guess it was about 1975. You see, he'd been born in 1899, and they had gold and silver coin, and they had paper money. And then he lived through 1933 when they took the gold away. He lived through 1965 when they took the silver away. So by 1975, my old Uncle Lyle, who's, you know, 76 years old, is able to sit there and say, now, boy, let me explain to you why it is that gold and silver is so important. But you see, all those old-timers that actually lived through it are dead and buried now. Which leaves the next generation, my dad. And my dad, born in 1917, he saw gold and silver coin until 1933 when he was a wee lad. And then, by the time he became an adult in 1940, we had paper money and silver. Kind of like the camel sticking his nose in the tent. Well, by the time my dad, you know, died about 1970, as I recall, by the time my generation comes along, we've lost our silver in 1965, and we're getting along quite nicely with just paper and clad coins. Most of you listening to me right now have been born after 1965. You've never known gold or silver. Nobody's ever explained it to you. And except for a rare few of you that might have read Pieces of Eight or some historical treatise on money, you don't really care too much about it one way or the other. However, we're now at a point where the conclusion to the matter is about to overwhelm us. We're now to the point where the budget deficit and the debt, now over $7 trillion and budget deficits of $0.5 trillion a year, are projected into the future, speaking now from the year 2004 forward, numbers that these boys, you know, in 1980, when this guy, 82, 88, when this guy Figge is out here on the stump talking to people about the national debt, making projections for the future, when people, you know, were listening to this guy, they couldn't grasp it either. You can only vote Republican or Democratic. So we voted for Reagan, we voted for Bush, we voted for Clinton, we voted for Bush. And the problem is being exacerbated. It's not being solved. It's getting bigger and bigger and worser, isn't it? All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Well, Joe Smith started the day early, having set his alarm clock made in Japan for 6 a.m. While his coffee pot made in Japan is perking, he puts his blow dryer made in Taiwan to work. Then he shaves with his electric razor made in Hong Kong. He puts on a dress shirt made in Taiwan. His designer jeans are made in Singapore and a pair of tennis shoes made in Korea. Then after cooking up some breakfast in his new electric skillet made in the Philippines, he sits down to figure out on his calculator made in Mexico how much he can spend today. Then after setting his watch made in Switzerland to the radio made in Hong Kong, he goes out and gets in his car made in Germany, goes looking as he has for many months for a good paying American job. After the end of another discouraging and fruitless day, Joe decides to relax for a while, so he puts on a pair of sandals made in Brazil, pours himself a glass of wine made in France, turns on his TV made in Japan, and ponders again why it is that he can't find a good paying American job. Now, instead of a good-paying American job, why doesn't Joe look for a good-paying American private business dealing in property instead of income? Now, if you'd like to tap into the power of private business, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? That's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge. And you can call right now. The number, 417-273-4967. And if you're online, why don't you go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for the General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, talking about modern money mechanics, Figge goes on to explain. He said, what does all of this mean? Well, it means that when we hit the $500 billion deficit here in 1995, going to $2 trillion deficit in 2000, we've lost our ability to control our economy by taxation, and we run the risk of something that I'm going to talk about. It's called hyperinflation. Now, notice that their projections back in 1982 showed that budget deficits, if you continued on just like we have been, would go from $128 to $500 billion by 1995. Now, the Bush people enacted a tax increase. And through various manipulations through the Federal Reserve, we kept the budget deficit a little lower than $500 billion a year. We went through the 1990s by borrowing from Social Security. See, Social Security was showing a $100 billion a year surplus, and so they put an IOU into the Social Security Trust Fund and took out the money and spent it. And then they said, well, see, we've almost got a balanced budget. Now, that's not good economics. That's deception, but then, you know, people like to deceive themselves, and that's what we've been doing. Americans believe that in the Clinton years we had budget surpluses. We never did. We just went to our savings plan, our IRA, and took the money out of that to pay our current operating expenses. And then when we get to retirement time, that money's going to be gone. You baby boomers, the money's gone. There's no money in Social Security. It's still running a surplus. Until 2012, it'll be running a surplus. And then in 2013 on, it'll be showing a deficit. Until 2032, when it'll be showing a $3.8 trillion deficit shortfall. Now, of course, we could solve these problems, but we're not going to. We don't want to take the strong medicine that's necessary, and Figge recognized that. He said, what this really means, back in 82, I said, well, we've got some time, and nobody's going to be stupid, so let's get to the people, and let's get the people to understand this thing. And I'm not very sorry to tell you that as I stand here in 1990, we're somewhere between 1990 and 93 in our budget projections, a little ahead of target. I was with Senator Robert Dole the other day. He just come from the White House budget negotiations, and he said, we didn't make any progress again today, but we will. Now, you've all heard about Graham Rudman. It used to be Graham, Rudman, and Hollings, but Senator Hollings said he wanted a divorce from the bill because it was such a travesty. Graham Rudman originally said we would have a zero deficit in 91, but revised that to 60 to 65 billion a couple of years later. Well, the reason that Congress runs around like chickens with their heads off right now is technically, unless they get a budget agreement, they've got to cut 100 billion out of the budget this year because they're at 168 billion. And the thing that I want to tell you is that the 168 billion you hear is a travesty. It's a lie foisted on the American people. Now remember, all of those IOUs that you were peeling out of your pension fund with your credit card fees, well, government doesn't count those as part of the cash deficit. We have for 6 years run an actual deficit in the U.S. government of over $250 billion. And this year we're running between $360 and $435 billion. Now let me explain that to you. You start with the Graham-Rudman bill. Now that's $168 billion, remember? Now, remember the credit card example when you took $100 away from the Kroger, the IRA, and you sent them an IOU? Well, the government is doing that to 9 trust funds, including Social Security, military pensions, railway pensions, and postal pensions. Uncle Sam is taking $120 billion in trust fund surpluses and then replacing that $120 billion with an IOU instead of funding them with cash. And they're funding them with the federal deficit. And they don't count those IOUs or the interest on them. And when those IOUs start coming due, the government is going to owe trillions in Social Security, which will be supporting more retirees with ever fewer workers. So that's the first thing that's been foisted off on the people. Now, the savings and loan crisis is another. Mossbacher, our country's head economist, made very sure when Bush stuck his neck out on the savings and loan crisis that those costs were taken off the deficit. Current estimates are that savings and loans will cost us about $500 billion overall and $100 billion next year. Now, there's another $100 billion that's not being counted. So the deficit has gone from $168 billion to $388 billion, and I haven't talked to you about the student loan problem yet, have I? I haven't talked to you about the $300 to $500 billion toxic waste cleanup that's going to come from our military bases. And I haven't talked to you about crack babies or AIDS or any new programs that Congress is talking about. Now, do you see this? Now, we're talking about the 1982 to 1990 period, about 8 years. This guy, Figge, now is working on a private commission called the Grace Commission. He's shocked. He's just an average, ordinary businessman. He takes a look at the numbers, and he is totally shocked by what he sees, and he's telling his audiences, it ruined, it spoiled my day. Then when he went to the congressman and he said, look at the problem that we have, Dick Armey looks at him and says, gosh, you've ruined my day. I didn't know that this problem was that bad. Now that's an economist. Dick Armey is an economist. Dick Armey is a CPA. Now, boys and girls, if your congressmen don't know what the problem is, we could hardly expect the average truck driver, plumber, carpenter, or electrician to grasp it, could we? Now, the truth of the matter is, I think that Armey grasps what's going on. As if Ron Paul can grasp it, I think that Dick Armey could. In fact, I'm sure that Ted Kennedy and Dianne Feinstein and the rest of these senators and congressmen, I think they understand a whole lot more than they're letting on. And there's an inevitable day of reckoning coming. What we don't know is when is this day of reckoning coming? In 2004, 2008, 2012, I don't know. I'm not a prophet. But I can certainly see that we're headed for insolvency in the same way that you could. You know, if you were spending $1,000 a month and you were taking in $900 and you were making it up on your credit cards, you could surely figure out that at some point in the future, I don't know just when, but at some point, I'm going to be buried so deep that I'm going to go into bankruptcy. I'm going to lose everything I've got. So Figge goes on and says, so we're running right now a true deficit of between $300 and $500 billion, and my estimate is that at $500 billion a year, we lose our capability to control that budget deficit by taxation. Now, don't ever think for a minute that Congress doesn't want inflation, because they know, and the only way that these senators and representatives know that you can pay off this debt is with inflated dollars. Now, if that isn't bad enough, the financial structure of the United States is now very tenuous. Now, let me give you a couple of examples dating back to 1988. We definitely have a recession on the horizon, and we're just beginning to see it. We're seeing it in furniture and housing, all through construction and in aerospace. So let's talk about our commercial banks. You know, since 1983, 713 commercial banks have failed. That's only 5% of the commercial banks in the United States, but when you fail 5% of your banks in your good times, well then, what do you think is going to happen when the bad times come about? Well, FDIC Chairman Bill Seidman came out the other day and he said, if we get a severe recession, the safety net that we have today that underpins our commercial banks will never hold. There just simply is not enough money in it. Now, most people don't realize this, but 13 insurance companies failed in 1988. Now, I'm talking about property and casualty, not just health insurance companies. 39 failed in 1989, so we've had 52 insurance companies fail within the last 2 years. Pretty shocking statistic, isn't it? Let me tell you that one again. 52 insurance companies failed in 1988 and 1989. Did you read about that? Did Dan Rather report that to you? Did you hear? Now, the other thing that you don't hear about is that the federal government is underwriting $5.8 trillion of debt from things that aren't truly government, such as deposit insurance, loan guarantees, pension programs, government-sponsored enterprises, direct loan programs, and it goes on and on. All of these are being funded. They're very popular. They buy votes. Now, if we get a severe turndown, and after 50-some years of recovery, it's got to be sitting out there somewhere. It's just inevitable. We're going to be, to steal the words of a man whose lips we all watched carefully, in deep doo-doo. That was President George Bush the First. Now, what I find so frightening is the rapid rate of deterioration. It's the old story that the light at the end of the tunnel may be an oncoming train. Well, when we can go 200 years and create less than $500 billion in debt, and in the next 16 years go to $3 trillion in debt, it's time to say that we're really seeing things get bad faster and faster. So the question is, well, what's going to happen? One of the people that I respect most in government is Chuck Bowser, B-O-W-S-H-E-R, Bowsher, I guess that's pronounced, the former Arthur Andersen partner who's Comptroller General of the United States. Now, remember, Arthur Andersen is the accounting company for Enron and a couple of three others of those biggies that went belly up. Arthur Andersen. Well, Chuck was sent to New York about a decade ago to straighten it out financially. He said that he and Governor Kerry sat at the table day after day, and Kerry made real tough decisions until they got New York into the kind of shape where they could sell its bonds again. And so I took my hyperinflation scenario to Chuck, and I said, Chuck, tell me I'm wrong. And he said, you're wrong. And I said, well, great, what's going to happen? Well, Chuck said, well, we're going to have a financial panic. We're going to get to the point where the central banks of the world, like Japan and Germany, can see that we're not going to be able to service our debt, and they're going to quit buying our notes. And I said, great, now we're going to have a fiscal panic, and we're not going to go to hyperinflation. Well, can you imagine a businessman standing around cheering, for a financial panic? But nothing happened, and after about 4 weeks, I started to wonder what those bonds were doing. I think you know that at one point, Japan was buying 35% of our debt. But in about the last 6 to 8 weeks, the Japanese market broke. Now, I found that the Japanese have scaled back, but the Saudis came in and replaced them 100%. Now, this is back in 1990. Now, the Japanese are busily buying our treasury bills and bonds. The dollar weakened, and then it came back a little stronger. It could well be that the Federal Reserve and George Bush are going to pull the economy of the United States out for another 3 or 4 years. I don't know. I will be amazed if they do. I have been amazed for the last 30 years because I thought in 79 or 80 the jig is up and this is it. And it's been my contention that the economic crisis that we're facing worldwide today in 2004 is just the tip of the iceberg. And I suspect that George Bush isn't going to be able to pull the fat out of the fire very much longer. Now, what if, perchance, he can do that? What if, perchance, we can pull the economy out like we did in 1991, 92, and have another 6 or 8 years? Well, then the debt's going to be higher, the deficits are going to be greater, and the collapse is going to be more severe when it occurs 8 or 10 years from now than it is today. And that's what Figge is telling us. Now, he goes on to say, now we're back to my scenario, which incidentally scares the hell out of me. What our charts show is that in 95, we're not going to be able to control our deficit and our debt by taxation. And we're going to move to what's called hyperinflation. And by that, I mean severe runaway inflation that leads to devaluation of the currency. In Brazil and Argentina, they have lopped 6 zeros off their money in the last few years. That meant if you had $1 million at the first lop, you then had $1,000. And the second lop, you had $1. And I'll talk a little bit about that. You see, during World War II, when I was fighting house to house in Germany, I found an old cigar box on the floor where a bunch of German money had spilled out. I picked it up and I looked at it, and it was Weimar Republic money from 1923. Totally worthless. So I picked up about 8 or 10 of those bills, and I liberated them and I brought them home. They hang in my office to this day. One especially frightens me because it's 100 million marks. In 1923, they were taking bushel baskets of those down to the store to try to buy potatoes and bread. And so that's a great reminder to me. To find out about hyperinflation, we looked at all of the countries in the world. The German and French experience with hyperinflation was too long ago. Israel is a microcosm. Russia is an unknown. Yugoslavia was just getting started. They were up about 2,000%. Then we looked at South America and we said, that's where it's at. So we picked Argentina, Brazil, and Bolivia as the best examples. We studied their economy. Now, the problem I run into when I talk to people about this is that they say, oh, you studied the Banana Republic. And I have two parts to my answer. First part is, welcome to the United States Banana Republic. And the second answer, and most people don't know this either, is that in 1938, the fifth largest market in the world was the country of Argentina. That's right. In 1938, the fifth largest economy in the world was Argentina. It was very sophisticated, very well run, and very knowledgeable. It had excellent agriculture, excellent mining. It had good resources. Now, they are the world's 78th largest market. Argentina, 1938, was number 5 in the world in its economic power, economic production. But by 1990, they dropped to 78th. America's number 1. Could we also drop to number 50, 75, or maybe 100? How is that going to impact upon you? Well, For our study, we were very fortunate because we were able to meet with 80 top businessmen in those three countries, Bolivia, Brazil, and Argentina. They weren't just businessmen, they were government officials, bankers, financial executives. Dr. Jerry Swanson, an economist from the University of Arizona, he led the team, and he took one of their group, controllers, and our director of purchasing. They took four trips over a two-year period. So we're not talking about some kind of a cursory test. We took a look at it for a period of 2 years. We studied their history. We took a look at their economies. We took three nations in South America. How did hyperinflation affect them? And for the answer to that, stand by and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Law Hour and the Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, it was negotiated by Moses out at Mount Sinai. You and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. Benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, George Bush Sr. back in 1992 said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. George Bush Sr. reiterated that in 2000. He said, what Americans want is jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, and the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not now, never has been measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. There's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. There's no money in public business, and there's no money in jobs, jobs, jobs. Now it's time that you cashed in on your inheritance and learned how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract and collect those benefits in gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil in real property instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now if you want to learn more about how to do just that, why don't you call for information on my CD Home School for Adults, and then order the free General Law CD package at the same time. Now that's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School, on the law in general. It's informative and it's entertaining. It's educational and it's free of charge. You can call right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send me an email request for your free General Law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're interjecting the Figge Commission report. It's actually the Grace Commission. Figge was the co-chairman of it. It was created by President Reagan in 1982. When they came back with their report, Reagan said, "That's bad news. I don't want to hear it." He discounted it and went about his business. George Bush, 1990, didn't make any changes either. Bill Clinton is a radical lib. He's not about to make any changes. Now, George Washington and our founding fathers did. After the collapse of the continental currency in 1783, everybody got wiped out. So from 1692 to 1792, the average loss for the average guy dealing in paper money was 90%. Well, get this. Between 1930 and 1996, the average loss was 96.5%. So from 1900 to 1996, in that period of time, in a 100-year period of time, we lost on average 1% per year. Starting in 1933, we lost that in about 70 years. Now, these are pretty heady topics, pretty heady subjects. The Federal Reserve puts out books called Modern Money Mechanics. You can order that, by the way, from your local Federal Reserve Bank. I got this one from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, along with five or six of their comic book issues, to teach Americans how their economy works. The average Joe Sixpack doesn't know, never learned in high school. He couldn't have learned in college even if he'd gone to college and studied economics. They don't teach it there. There are a few private schools. There are some books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters that are written by people who are passionately interested in this topic of gold and silver money, hard money versus soft. They're not listened to. Nobody's paying any attention to them. Now, the thing that happened is that all 80 of these businessmen said to us, "What's wrong with the United States? You're on exactly the same course that we were on, just 20 to 30 years behind us." Now, here are the businessmen of Latin America, Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, looking at the Grace Commission, and they're saying, "You fools in America, can't you learn from our mistakes?" They said, "Everything that we did wrong, you're doing wrong. For example, you have large deficits. You have a deterioration in your balance of payments. You have eroded the confidence of your currency. You have a tendency to blame outsiders and then call for protectionism. And then finally, the exchange value of your currency is falling twice since the mid-70s. We've devalued our currency, and there's pressure now to devalue it again." They said all five factors are in place, and the United States is following the path to hyperinflation. "And we can't understand why you don't see what's coming." Well, when Jerry came back from his last trip, I said, "Jerry, give me a synopsis." He said, "Well, for years in my economics courses, when I attended the University of Arizona, I've been teaching that deficits cause inflation." Then he said, "They do. I just saw it in three countries." And I said, "Okay, tell me about hyperinflation. How much time do you have before hyperinflation sets in?" And he said, "Well, in Brazil, it set in 3 days. Did you hear that? Hyperinflation, when it came about in Brazil, it didn't come about over 1, 2, 3, or 4 years like it did in Germany. In Germany, it was 1920 to 1923. It occurred over a period of 36 months. In Brazil, it set in 3 days. And he said, "Now the terrible thing about hyperinflation is once it gets started, you can't stop it. You see them trying to stop it now in Argentina. You see them trying to stop it now in Brazil." Brazil is a wonderful example. They put in wage and price controls, just like Nixon did back in 73. And they seized 80% of the capital of the people. They did all of the right things. But 54% of the people work for the government, and they turned around and gave them pay increases to keep pace. The government workers are reinflating right now in Argentina. So during the same time we were studying this, Argentina's inflation hit 5,000%. Brazil's got to 5,000%, and Bolivia's got to 25,000% for bursts up to 50,000. Did you get that? 25,000% inflation with bursts up to 50,000% inflation. Let me tell you how bad that is. We have a book here that we published on how to survive hyperinflation. If you're a businessman, we have a picture of a guy with a huge bag going into a bank in Bolivia. At the bank, they simply weighed the bag and they gave him a note of exchange. Now, the terrible thing about that is that nobody looked in the bag. They didn't care whether he had newspapers in there, or old socks, or $1,000 bills, $10,000 bills, or dollar bills. They didn't care what was in it. It was worthless. That's what happens in hyperinflation. It's what happened in 1783 when the cliche was coined, it isn't worth a continental. Our continental currency collapsed. We've been through that here in the United States. Our founding fathers thought that they would eliminate that problem by eliminating paper money in our Constitution. They failed. We Americans have accepted paper money, and we now promote it as if we thought it up. It was our idea. So to say that this can't happen here in America is wrong. I hear the argument periodically that the reason that it won't happen to us is that our deficit is only 5% of our gross national product. The Brazilian and Argentine deficits are only 8% of their gross national products. It's not a huge jump from 5 to 8%. So when these economists give you the garbage that our deficit is only a few percentage points of the gross national product, it doesn't mean a thing. If inflation hit South American standards, in 1 month, the cab out to the airport would go from $15 to $600. Our guys went into a supermarket in South America and watched a lady pick up a loaf of bread only to have the price change before she could get to the cash register. And the standard joke down in South America is this. You take a cab, don't take a bus. If in a cab, you don't have to pay until you get out. And by then, the money is worth less. Right now, Yugoslavia has over 2,000% inflation. You have inflation in Israel. Now, you don't read much about it, but you have a very severe inflation now in Russia. There's inflation going on all around the world, and when you look behind it, it's due to the deficits of their governments. Now, for 8 years, I've been ready to beat my head against Congress, but it wasn't until we got to this so-called budget crisis that I could even get in to see these congressmen to make any sense to them. There was never a more important time than right now. There's never been a more important issue. It isn't a Democratic issue. It is not a Republican issue. It's an American issue. And we've got 5 years left. So before we lose our capability to offset this problem through taxation, and even that would be about 100% taxation, The voice of the people has got to be heard, and this is why I'm talking to the League of Women Voters. We need strong operations out in the field to go and sit down with these guys and say, look, you either wake up or you're not coming back to Congress. Well, sure, Medicaid is great. Well, sure, Social Security is great. And all these other entitlements, they're just as great, aren't they? But we aren't going to be around here in 5 or 10 years if you don't balance this budget and balance it right now. And a tax increase? Well, I guarantee that this tax increase is not going to balance it. They're going to spend 68 cents more than you give them. Now, in closing, he said, I want to say to you, don't think that it can't happen here in America. If Argentina can go from 5th to 78th because of this kind of deficit problem, we Americans can go from 1st to 50th just as easy. Now, you hear people jumping on us over becoming a second-rate power. And here I'm talking about becoming a third-rate power in the United States. That's what we're really talking about here. When our economy collapses, do you think that we're going to have the same standard of living, that we're going to have the same prestige in the world that we have today? But I can guarantee you this, if this thing hits, and I hope to God I'm wrong and Chuck Boucher is right, but if it hits, then your savings, your bonds, your insurance, your pension, you might as well use them for toilet paper, because they're not going to be good for anything else. And we know that from what we've seen around the world. So I think when you go to bed at night, just kneel down and you pray that I'm nuts and that Chuck Boucher is right, and that we get a fiscal panic here in about the next 2 years while we've still got time to fix our economy. And with that happy message, I'm going to close this, and I'd be glad to take any questions. So thank you very much for the opportunity to talk to you. Now remember, this is Figgy, Figgy International. Guy's name? What was his name? I'll turn back here to page one. Harry E. Figgy, Jr., co-chairman of the Grace Commission. Pretty sobering terms, pretty sobering words, I'd say. I read that back about 1988, and I said, well, okay, one of these days, I've been preparing for it. There are people out here in the world that are preparing for this economic disaster, this catastrophe. When it happens in the United States, just like in the 1920s, it's not going to happen just here. It's going to affect you Canadians. When we Americans can no longer pay our bills, when our money becomes worthless, and you Canadians depend upon your exports to the United States to keep your own economy going, what's going to happen to the Canadian economy when we can't pay you? When our money is worthless. Which it already is, you just haven't come to that conclusion yet. So you still send us the goods, and we still send you the money, and you keep spending the money, believing that it's good. And all of the money that we Americans have today, right now, today, in 2004, if we took all of our money and went in to Walmart, walked into all the stores. Remember, 67% of our economy is predicated upon consumer spending. Only a third of it's predicated upon production. We're great consumers, not producers. We used to have a production economy based upon commodities. A man would go out and work on his mine, pull gold out of the mine or silver out of the mine. He would work for a mining company. In the 1920s and 30s, we had mining operations. We produced money, and then we coined that money and put it into circulation. That was money that came into circulation by work. Roosevelt took our gold away, stuck it in Fort Knox, closed the mines down, and said, we'll just make the money that we need. That's communism. That's the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's the fifth plank. That's the second plank. A heavy progressive income tax and a central bank. As Paul Warburg said, you know, what you Americans need is a central bank like all the nations around us. Well, what do you think's going to happen? All of you people out there in Australia, New Zealand, and Canada, and Western Europe, and South Korea, and Japan, what are you going to do with our worthless money? How are you going to pay your bills when you deliver your Toyotas to America and we pay you with our worthless money that nobody else will accept because you won't buy anything? And if we cashed in everything that we've got today, we could get 2% of the money that's in circulation. Of all the dollars that are in circulation, now take all of the goods and services that are available to us, we could cash it in, get 2%. From 1692 to 1792, the people lost 90% of their purchasing power. We Americans have lost 96.5% of our purchasing power already. And if we went in and cashed in the morning, it would be 98%. You know, we're getting up close to where we're just about ready to lose 100% of everything we've got. How are you going to make your payments? Mull it over. We got to cut it off right here. We'll be back tomorrow night, and we'll take it up right here with the Ron Paul Report, with this in mind. The Law Hour website, remember, is updated weekly, and it has our radio log, schedule, and archives. It can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. And all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events. Well, I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.